Creator. We do thank you very much that you have revealed yourself to us, that we can taste the good word of God and the powers of the world to come through your Spirit and through the Scriptures. We thank you, Father, for giving us this infallible book, that we've all had Bibles that we can learn and study and reread, and we know that it hasn't always been that way. Your people back in the Middle Ages had to memorize big parts of the Bible because they didn't have one to carry around with them and to refer to and have their own individual copy to study. So we thank you now for your guidance in this class. We look forward to more time together in the future and different types of classes. We do especially appreciate the books that we've been able to cover and the variety of meaning and teaching and benefit that they bring to us. We know we've only scratched the surface and really learned how to dig into so many things that are there in the depths of your mind and your inspiration and your Scriptures. So we ask that you would just help us to take this as a foundation to really feed on the Word and feast on the Word. We do ask your continued inspiration and vigor and direction on Mr. Armstrong, and that you'd continue to give him foresight and insight and wisdom and favor. He might continue to lead us in this end time work. We just commit this class into your hands now and give you much thanks for it in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Okay, we're ready to launch into Psalm 79. Psalm 79 and 80 tie together with the national attack against Israel discussed. So you see in the beginning of Psalm 80 what actually should be the ending of Psalm 79, that it's set to the trumpet, or it's a marching type melody, set to the trumpet, shoshanim, the trumpets shaped like lilies. O God, the nations are come into your inheritance. Your holy temple they have defiled. They have laid Jerusalem on heaps. So this could refer to any number of times when you think about the times that Jerusalem has been invaded and the city walls and the buildings torn down. And yet apparently this is referring to a time when the temple wasn't devastated, but was just defiled. So it may have been a time when someone went into the Holy of Holies and defiled the temple, but it doesn't say it was destroyed, but just pillaged or corrupted. The dead bodies of your servants have they given to be food to the fowls of the heaven, the flesh of your saints unto the beasts of the earth. Now, of course, symbolically, that's talking about world empires likened to vultures or eagles or bears or lions or rams and he-goats. So when you think about Bible symbols, it's talking about the dead carcasses of the nation of Israel being devoured by these various nations of the world. Their blood they've shed, word that means pour out. You see the word, verse 6, pour out your wrath on the heathen. So apparently there's a play on words here that the blood of the saints, they've poured out like water. So God, you pour out your wrath on them like water. So many times you lose the beauty of the Hebrew in the translating into English. There was none to bury them. So you can think of many other scriptures that parallel that, when the dead bodies lie around without any time to bury them or without anybody that cares about burying them. Now, we're become a reproach to our neighbors. a scorn and derision to those that are around about us. Now, if you think the people of Judah or the people of Israel are that today, of course, just wait to see how much it's going to be more so that way in the future. How long, eternal? So here's another one of those many how longs we've run into. How long will you be angry? So God's wrath is the captivity and the plagues on the nations. Shall your jealousy burn like fire? How long? Pour out your wrath on those nations that haven't known you, on the kingdoms that haven't called on your name. So he shows plainly a lot of the enemy that's going to be troubling the people of Israel in the last days are peoples of different religions. They've never really known the true God. For they have devoured Jacob and laid waste his dwelling place. Oh, remember not against us former iniquities. Let your tender mercies speedily prevent us or come to meet us. So the word prevent back in the old 1611 King James language in many cases means the opposite today. So they're not asking for God's tender mercies to prevent them, but to come to them, to come to meet them. For we're brought very low. Help us, O God of our salvation, for the glory of your name. And, of course, many of the great things in the Bible were done for that reason, not because of the people, but for the glory of God's name. And deliver us, and purge away our sins. And here, of course, the Hebrew word is kafer, atone for or cover our sins, for your name's sake. Wherefore should the nations say, where is their God? Well, this is the so-called Israel of God, the so-called Christian world. Where is their God? Let him be known among the nations in our sight, heathen or nations, either way, by the revenging of the blood of your servants which is shed. So God goes back to his own law that whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. So blood is revenge. Let the sighing of the prisoner come before you. So a lot of the people of God were taken captive as prisoners. They weren't all destroyed. According to the greatness of your arm or your power, preserve you those that are appointed to die, and render to our neighbors sevenfold into their bosom. So apparently for stealing lives that were productive, they were applying that old law back there of restoring sevenfold. Rendered our neighbors sevenfold into their bosom, their reproach wherewith they have reproached you, O Eternal. So we, your people, and sheep of your pasture, will give you thanks forever. We'll show forth your praise to all the generations. So the beginning of the title on Psalm 80 belongs at the end of 79 to the chief musician on these lilies or trumpets. For this trumpet-type message of Psalm 79. Now, Psalm 80 has the same type of message. Give ear, O Shepherd of Israel. You might want to tie into your margin there, Shepherd of Israel, Genesis 48:15. Because back in the chapters here, Genesis 48 and 49, Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near unto him. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly, because Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk, the God which fed me all my life long unto this day. So he's talking about God as a shepherd here of the descendants of Jacob or Joseph. And then chapter 49, carrying on this same theme, Genesis 49, talking about Joseph, verse 22. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well whose branches run over the wall. The archers have sorely grieved him and shot at him and hated him. But his bow abode in strength. The arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty, or the mighty God of Jacob. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. So here it directly associates this shepherd with Joseph in these statements about the various tribes and what would befall them in the latter day. So true to that same form here in Psalm 80, when he's going to talk about Joseph, he refers back to the shepherd of Israel. So many cases you might think of Joseph, how much God is foretelling our day. Is he speaking here about Ephraim and Manasseh and Canada and Australia and South Africa? And that in our day, mainly God has been the shepherd of Joseph, on whose name Israel was named? Well, I've never taken all the places in the Bible that it refers to Joseph and put them all together, or even Ephraim. But I don't think God was just referring to certain tribes here. When you get a little later and you notice in verse 2, he talks about Ephraim and Benjamin and Manasseh. Of course, these were all three descended from Rachel, and these were three that marched together when the tribes went up three and three and three and three. These three went together, and they were all three from the same mother. So you might notice that back in Numbers 2. Verses 18 to 22. On the west side shall be the standard of the camp of Ephraim according to their armies. The captain of the sons of Ephraim, Elishama the son of Ahimad, and his host, those that were numbered of them, 40,500. By him the tribe of Manasseh. Verse 22, then the tribe of Benjamin. So he has these three associated together, marching in the rear when the 12 tribes go out. So in Psalm 80, with reference to the shepherd of Israel, thou that leadest Joseph like a flock, thou that dwellest above the cherubim, between them in a sense of, if you'd look, he'd be between, but he's above them, before Ephraim and Benjamin and Manasseh, stir up your strength and come and save us. So he may well here be referring to Ephraim and Manasseh in the last days, how God is going to specifically be the shepherd of them. Then in verse 3, he talks about, turn us again, and not from captivity in this case, but from their wrong or sin or idolatry, O God, and cause your face to shine, and we shall be saved. Now you might notice another thing here as you go through this psalm. He actually uses a progressive reference to God. In verse 3 he says, O God. Then in verse 7 he says, O God of hosts. And then in verse 19 he says, O eternal God of hosts. So he's building on the name of God, just starting out simply, O God, and then adding to it. Cause your face to shine. Once again, the way God's approval or favor comes. O eternal God of hosts, how long will you be angry against the prayer of your people? So that's a good verse to mark as prayer, because God can be angry against the prayer of people if they're praying hypocritically, if they're praying in a mocking sense. You feed them with the bread of tears. You give them tears to drink in great measure. You make us a strife unto our neighbors. Our enemies laugh among themselves. So here they're mocking. So you see, the story comes back to the downfall, the marching enemy against the people of Israel again. But more specifically in Psalm 80 about the sons of Joseph in reference there specifically. Turn us again, O God of hosts, verse 7, cause your face to shine, and we shall be saved. Now, causing God's face to shine, you might jot down number 625 if you want to go way back to the first time a reference is made to God's face shining on Israel when they pleased him. You have brought a vine out of Egypt. And this shows the unity of the Bible. You know, we read about a vine out of Egypt in Isaiah 5, the first seven verses. We read about Israel being a vine out of Egypt in Jeremiah 2:21 and 12:10. So again and again you find this reference to the vine that God brought out of Egypt. And yet back there in Genesis 49, verse 22, it said that Ephraim was a fruitful vine that grew over the wall, actually spread out beyond its original territory. It ended up in Australia and Canada. It didn't just grow in Great Britain where God planted it, but it grew over the wall. It went beyond the territory that God had set there as the one homeland, the base land. You've brought a vine out of Egypt. You've cast out the nations and planted it. Notice that. God cast out the Indians. God cast out the Druids. God cast the people out of the lands that he sent Ephraim and Manasseh into. You prepared room before it and did cause it to take deep root, and it filled the land. The hills were covered with the shadow of it. The boughs thereof were like the goodly cedars. Still talking about the vine that he brought out of Egypt. She sent out her boughs under the sea, speaking of the Mediterranean, and her branches, and there the term is more referring to roots, under the Euphrates. So it shows God meant for the vine to be planted all the way from the Mediterranean all the way to the Euphrates. And if you read their boundary back in Genesis, you'll find out that's what God said. Now, they never did attain that territory, but they should have. Why have you then broken down her hedges, so that all they which pass by the way do pluck her? So we lost the pride of our power, and our defenses were broken down. So the hedges God had set about the 12 tribes, and more specifically Ephraim and Manasseh and Benjamin, anyone that passes by is able to pluck. The boar out of the forest does waste it. The wild beast of the field does devour it. Here again, symbolically, world's nations. Return, we beseech you, O God of hosts. Look down from heaven, behold, and visit this vine, and the vineyard your right hand has planted, and the branch that you made strong for yourself. So that's talking about the Messiah, the branch that came out of Israel, that came out of the vine God planted. So there are many references to the Messiah as you go through here. Then he comes back talking about the vine. It got burnt with fire and got cut down. They perish at the rebuke of your countenance. So the ones who cut down the vine that came out of Egypt that God planted are going to be the ones that are destroyed by Christ's return. That's what that verse says. They, the ones who burned the vine and cut it down, they perish at the rebuke of your countenance. The brightness of your coming is going to destroy their power, put them down. Let your hand be upon the man of your right hand. So here again he's talking about one to come, on the Son of Man whom you've made strong for yourself. So will not we go back from you. Make us alive, restore and revive us. We'll call on your name. Turn us again, O eternal God of hosts. Cause your face to shine, and we'll be saved. Now, of course, the first part of 81 actually belongs on 80 there. So this is to the chief musician. A marching song is what Psalm 80 should be. Now, Psalm 81 and 82 actually go together. Talking about Israel's waywardness and their captivity. So they tie in a great deal with 79 and 80, but 81 and 82 are also to the sound of the trumpet, to to the punishment or trouble on Israel, Psalm of Asaph, sing aloud unto God our strength. Make a joyful noise to the God of Jacob. Take a psalm. Bring here the timbrel. Raise the song would be better. Take a psalm. You know, that. What does that mean to you? Take a psalm. Well, raise the song. Now, that means a lot, you know. Stir up a song. Raise the song. Bring here the timbrel. The pleasant harp with the psaltery. Blow up the trumpet. Of course, this is the Hebrew word shofar that they blow on the Feast of Trumpets. Blow up the trumpet. Shofar. It's not the other type of trumpets. In the new moon, in the time appointed, on our solemn feast day. Of course, that's the Feast of Trumpets. That's the only one that's on the new moon. And notice what he calls that in verse 4. For this was a statute. They always are. Statutes, holy days are all statutes. It was a law of the God of Jacob. This he ordained in Joseph. Now that's kind of interesting how in our day, the majority of people doing God's work are Canadians and Australians and Americans and New Zealanders and British and South Africans. And is that what that's talking about? He ordained this in Joseph for a testimony. Well, apparently nobody else to much degree responds to the trumpet. You know, when you think about Norway or Sweden or Denmark or various countries that were supposed to be in our among the tribes of Israel, how many of them respond? How many of them are in the church? You know, how many of them are involved in doing the work? So maybe there's a lot more in these scriptures about Ephraim and Manasseh in the last days and Joseph than we've ever given credit for. But this was a statute and a law that God ordained in Joseph for a testimony. Of course, it began back there when he went out through the land of Egypt. I removed his shoulder from the burden. So God delivered them out of the bondage of Egypt. His hands were delivered from those baskets that they carried all that mud with straw in it to make bricks with. The word pots there is better baskets. Even Egyptian paintings show these baskets. You saw it in the Ten Commandment movie, how they carried that material for making bricks. You called in trouble and I delivered you. I answered you from the secret place of thunder. So man still hadn't figured out. He might figure scientifically what would enable thunder to roll, but where does it start, you know? Like where does the night begin? You know? Where is the edge of darkness, you know? Well, man hadn't figured that out yet. So God says, I answered you from the secret place of thunder. I proved you at the waters of Meribah. Now think about that, and then connect that with what he's going to say afterward. So after you go back over and think about what he's written beforehand, then you come and read what he says after. Hear, O my people, and I'll testify to you. O Israel, if you'll hearken to me, there shall no strange God be in you, neither shall you worship any strange God. Now in the King James, you read right through there and you don't realize there are two different terminologies here for strange God. It's not one and the same. The strange God in the first line is like Psalm 44 and verse 20, or Isaiah 43 and verse 12. That's where that Hebrew word is used. Then in the second line, neither shall you worship any strange god. It's a different, like Deuteronomy 32:12, where this Hebrew word is used. So the word strange, as we know, means alien or foreign. One that doesn't belong to you, that isn't yours. A strange woman is someone other than your wife. So here he's talking about different kinds of gods of strangers. They weren't all the same, you know. Some were nature gods and some were animal gods, and some were heavenly bodies that were called gods. So there are two different words with reference to strange gods. Then he says, none of those shall be with you. You can't worship any of those. I am the eternal, your God. And of course, that's the very name he used when he gave the law back there in Exodus 20. The eternal, your Elohim, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. Open your mouth wide and I'll fill it. So I'm the God that provides for you and gives you the abundant life and began you coming out of Egypt. Wasn't some stone or some golden calf, but my people wouldn't hearken to my voice. Israel didn't have a mind for me. They put me out of their mind. They didn't want to think about it. The Hebrew really is more meaningful there. They willed. They, in their mind, they didn't want to think about God. That's what a lot of people do. If you want to bring up about Christmas, well, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to think about it. They don't want you to get it in their head. They'd rather not know about it. So God says, I gave them up. That's a good verse to remember when Ezekiel 20, you know, talks about God gave them up to statutes that weren't good. All the Protestant world says, yeah, see there, those old holy days weren't good. God gave them up to statutes that weren't good. Well, if you read the rest of that chapter, the statutes that weren't good were the statutes of the nation of Israel that their rebel leaders gave them instead of God's statutes. God gave them his statutes that were good, and they rejected them. So God just turned and gave them up to statutes of their own that weren't good. But this is the same Hebrew verb here, gave them up, turned them over to it, withdrew and let them go ahead if that's what they wanted to do. Wait, that's the worst thing God could do, you know. God gave Cain up to go the way he pleased. God gave Adam and Eve up to go the way they chose. So God gives you up. He won't force you to go his way. They walked in their own counsels. Oh, that my people had hearkened to me. Oh, that Israel had walked in my ways. I should soon have subdued their enemies, and they would have lived from the Mediterranean all the way to the Euphrates, and turned my hand against their adversaries. The haters of the Eternal should have submitted themselves unto him. So he shows there, you know, if you didn't go God's way, then you're haters of the Eternal. Well, their time should have endured forever. He should have fed them also with the finest of the wheat, fattest of the wheat, it's also translated, with honey out of the rock, I would have satisfied you. Now, Psalm 82 we read earlier as one of the millennial psalms, so we'll skip over that and go on to 83. Here again is a song psalm. Some are psalm songs. This is a song first and a psalm secondly of Asaph. Keep not you silence, O God. Don't hold your peace, and be not still, O God. And there the word is El. For lo, your enemies make a tumult. Now, we read that way back in the first part of Psalms where it said, why do the heathen assemble in this? Psalm 2 is what we read. The kings of the earth set themselves, the rulers take counsel together against the Eternal, the heathen tumultuously assemble. So now he's coming back to what we read way back there in Psalm 2. But notice the enemies of Israel at the last day, when the prayer is for God not to keep silence or not hold his peace any longer. Who are these enemies? Well, they roar like the waves of the sea. They're like a tumult. They that hate you have lifted up the head. In other words, they're haughty, they're proud. They say like that woman of Revelation, I am and there's none beside me. I'll never know widowhood and loss of children. They've lifted up the head. They say they're God sitting in the temple of God. Well, they work lying wonders and miracles. So they get haughty and they have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people. So it's a group of nations together as the enemies of Israel in the last day. And right in our time, they're taking crafty counsel against God's people of Israel, consulted against God's hidden ones. So even there are some that God promises that he's going to hide. So everywhere you read about a place of safety or a place of hiding. But they're even going to try to go out against those that God hides. Now notice what they've said in verse 4. They have said, come, let's cut them off from being a nation. Of course, that's what the Nazis tried to do to the Jews back in the last war. They tried to destroy the peoples of Judah. They did exactly what that verse says. So Satan inspired a group of allies to lift up the head, to take crafty counsel against the nation of Judah, to consult against God's people. Let's wipe them out so they're never a nation again. Let's destroy Jews forever out of the earth. Now, apparently they're going to think the same thing about Israel in our day. That the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. So that's what Satan's going to try to do, whether those people say that or not. They have consulted together with one consent. So these are those 10 kings in Revelation that are going to give their power to the beast for a short season. They've consulted together. They're of one mind. They are confederate, a group of allies. And the odd thing, when he talks about being confederate against God, he lists 10 countries. Not the same 10 that'll be there in the last time, but as a duality, as an antitype. Notice the 10 he lists here. Ishmaelites, Moab, Hagarines, Gebel, Ammon, Amalek, Philistines, Asher, children of Lot. So here he talks about a confederacy. He talks about lifting up the head, crafty counsel against God's people. And then he lists 10. Now here he talks about the tabernacles of Edom. And of course you'd know that wouldn't be Sukkoth, God's word for feast tabernacles. The Hebrew word oil is the word here, for just regular word for tents. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, of Moab and the Hagarines, Gebel and Ammon and Amalek, the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre. Asher also is joined with them. They've helped the children of Lot. Then he says, think about that. Or tie that in with what's going to come afterward. So what's going to happen when these nations, confederate against God's people, try to wipe out Israel from being a name? What's going to happen? Well, he tells you now on the other side of that, Selah. Do unto them as unto the Midianites. So he takes you back to the time of Judges 7 and says, remember what God did to the Midianites? And now he begins to list individual leaders by name, individual kings, and he lists 7 of them. So in a way, he gives you 10 horns and 7 heads, even right here in old Psalm 83. Because look at these 7 he gives. And interestingly enough, it verifies the book of Judges, because it goes right down the line in the same sequence they are in the book of Judges. So look who these people are. Sisera, Judges 4:15. As to Jabin, Judges 4:23. At the brook of Kishon, which perished at Endor, they became as dung for the soil, the ground, the same word as Adam, Adama, for earth. Make their nobles like Oreb, Judges 7:25, and like Zeeb, same verse. Yea, all their princes as Zeba, Judges 8, verses 5 and 21, and as Zalmunna, same verses. So it gives them right in the very progressive order that they were there in the book of Judges. Who said, let's take to ourselves the houses of God in possession. Now, when you read that in the King James, you start scratching your head and say, houses of God? I wonder what that means. Does that mean Shiloh and these other places that used to be where God's name was? No. The Hebrew word here is not houses at all. It's talking about pleasant pastures, like Psalm 23, verse 2, or Psalm 65, verse 12. So they're not talking about houses of God. Let's take for inheritance. Oh, my God, make them like a wheel. And, of course, in Hebrew, the word wheel is galgal, any rolling thing. But back in that day, they're saying a tumbleweed, you know, a rolling thing, like a tumbleweed in West Texas. Or back in their day, it was the wild artichoke. Their branches were about equal in length, and then when they got ripe and dry, and they'd break off at the root, and the wind would blow them just like a tumbleweed. Isaiah 17:13 talks about the same thing. Talks about chaff and a rolling thing. So that's what the prayer is, that God would make these Confederate rebels against his people like a tumbleweed rolling away. As the stubble, of course that's the word for straw that's left when you take the wheat and oat kernels away from the rest, then you have stubble or straw. As the fire burns the wood, as the flame sets the mountains on fire, so pursue them. Not persecute, but pursue them. Like fire pursues stubble and rolls like a tumbleweed over it. Make them afraid with your storm. Fill their faces with shame, that they may seek your name, O Eternal. Let them, these enemies, be confounded and troubled forever. Yea, let them be put to shame and perish. That men may know that you, whose name alone is Jehovah, one of three places in the whole King James translation, you find them transliterating that word out into the translation. It's totally unfounded in Scripture. Now, if you've ever studied how the Jehovah's Witnesses came up with the name Jehovah, you know, they call God the four-letter God, because the letters are just YHVH. And how do you pronounce that, though? Well, it's hard to pronounce four consonants together without any vowels in there. So they figure just take vowels out of the other main titles of God and put those in so you can at least pronounce the name. But you can't tell whether to put Y-E or Y-A or Y-O. How do you know which one to put first? Well, it depends on which title of God you think's the highest, the most important. So it's totally an unfounded biblical name to go around saying, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. First place, you've never witnessed Jehovah, so you can't be a Jehovah's Witness. But it's really a dumb name for man to try to use. Whose name alone is Yahweh, YHVH, however you want to say that. You're the Most High over all the earth. So here he's using some of the different names of God, Elyon, Most High, E-L-Y-O-N, over all the earth. Now that doesn't sound like God is just the God of the Jews, does it? It doesn't sound like he's the God of Palestine, he's the God of Israel. No, he's the God of over all the earth. So that was to the chief musician. Again, a marching song with a trumpet tone to it. Now, Psalm 84 is another one of the millennial psalms that we covered before. A couple of things I would like to mention, though, going across here. How lovely, amiable are your tabernacles. Here again, it's not sukkah. He's not talking about temporary dwellings the Israelites wandered in. He's talking about habitations, mishkan, the Hebrew word. So how lovely are God's temple at Jerusalem or Moriah or Bethel or wherever. Then he comes on and we've read, you know, I used to wonder when we sing this one psalm on the Sabbath day about birds building their nests on the altars, and I thought, that what on earth that got to do with religion, you know? That never did make sense to me. It just didn't jive. You know, your brain just kind of did a flip-flop when you sang that, or mine did. Well, it doesn't mean that. So let's straighten that part out here. Verse 2, my heart and my flesh cry out for the living El. That's the name God there, it's just the El. Yea, the sparrow, any bird, has found an house. So what he's saying here is, like the birds have found the houses, like the swallows have found the nests. So different kinds of birds have found different kinds of nests. A sparrow has one kind of a nest, and a swallow has another kind, where they always go back to, on like the swallows down here at Capistrano, where they lay their young. Even so, you know, verse 3 is really in parentheses, the first part of it in the Hebrew sense. From, you have a parenthesis, yea, the sparrow, like the sparrow, has found a house, and like the swallow has found a nest for herself where she can lay her young. Close parenthesis. Even so, I found the house, God. You're altars. And that's what he's saying. He doesn't say, go in and see the bird's nest on the altars. No, that doesn't say that. There are two altars, of course. The brazen altar of burnt offering, and then the golden altar of incense. So that was David's nest, or the place he found to raise his young, was before God on these altars. Now, we've covered that psalm, so we better skip on over to 85 so we can cover as many as we can. Here again is a psalm for the sons of Korah. There were nine that were entitled that. This is the next to the last one. Eternal, you've been favorable unto your land. Notice verse 2, your people. So he's connecting land and people here. You've been favorable to your land. You've forgiven the iniquity of your people. Now, of course, the last part of verse 1, you've brought back the captivity of Jacob. Now, when had he brought back the captivity of Jacob? You know, when the 10 tribes were taken into captivity, they never did come back. So it's a puzzle. They can't figure that out. So they say, oh, well, this must be talking about when Absalom drove David out of his capital, and then God brought David back into his capital city. That must be it. Well, they've got to find some place in history to force it in, you know. They don't believe it's about our day, but it's for future. When did God ever bring back the captivity of Jacob? Well, he never did. He never has. He's going to, though. So here again, this has to be talking about in the future. That's when God's going to be favorable to his land of Israel, after he brings back the captivity of Jacob, after he has forgiven the missing the mark. No, not the missing the mark in this case, the perverseness, the Hebrew word zavon, of your people. You have covered, and here's a different word for covered, sin. So one of our ex-ministers launched out, half-researched, and said in the Old Testament they didn't have forgiveness of sin. Their sins were just covered by sacrifice, that there wasn't any forgiveness of sin until the New Testament. Well, that isn't true. Here's a different word for covered. This word does mean concealed. The Hebrew word is kesa, K-E-S-A-H. But it's not the word kafar that meant to atone that we saw earlier. So some sin was covered by sacrifice, but it also refers to sin being purged or taken away in the Old Testament. You covered all their sin, missing the mark there, Cheta. Think about that, Selah. Then connect that forgiveness with the blessing that's to come after that forgiveness. So, after mentioning being favorable, bringing back the captivity, forgiving and covering, then he says, Selah, and then he says, you've taken away all your wrath. There are no more 7 last plagues. They're all gone. You've turned yourself from the fierceness of your anger. You've destroyed the destroyers of the earth and put a halt to the human annihilation. So now you've turned yourself from the fierceness of your anger. So now all you've got to do, God, is turn us, O God, of our salvation. Cause your anger toward us to cease. Will you be angry with us forever? Will you draw out your anger to all generations? Will you not revive us again that your people may rejoice in you? Show us your grace, your mercy, your long-loving kindness, O Eternal. Grant us your salvation. I'll hear what El, God, the Eternal, is going to speak, because he's going to speak peace to his people and to his saints, his grace ones or called out ones, but let them not turn again to folly. Surely his salvation is near, then to fear him. So once you learn that lesson, then salvation is near, that glory, the glory of God, can come back and dwell in the land where God had to take it away because of the sin earlier. Mercy and truth are met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed, met, come together. Truth shall spring out of the earth, and righteousness shall look down from heaven. Yea, the Eternal shall give that which is good, and our land shall yield her increase. Now that's a millennial statement. The curse is taken away. The land yields its increase. The sower overtakes the harvester. Righteousness shall go before him and shall set us in the ways of his steps. So in a way, that's a partly millennial psalm after the captivity and the punishment. Then all of a sudden he sobered up and realized, behold, these are the lawless, ungodly. Hebrew word, rasha, they're the lawless, who prosper in this age. They increase in riches. Verily, I've cleansed my heart in vain. Oh, is that right? You know, I get that feeling when I counsel with people sometimes, that they are talking about some other church person and what they did, and then they're trying to excuse or justify themselves doing it. And when, you know, I had a teacher used to say, two uglies don't make a pretty. But, you know, people say that. They say, it's almost as if they envy somebody that got to go astray. You know what? That guy didn't come into the church till he's 40. He got to sow all these wild oats and have all a good time. And that isn't true at all. But, you know, that's the way the human mind looks at things. So he said, look at this, all this striving and growing and fasting and overcoming, and verily I've cleansed my heart in vain. The wicked get all the fun anyway. You know, that's, if you read some of the so-called Christian writings, they say that's one reason God has to have a hell, because the unchristian have all the fun in this life, so it stands to reason they're going to get it afterward. And those of us Christians who suffer and go without in this life, boy, we'll laugh when they get it. Boy, that, wait till we get into the doctrine of hell, you'll find that's the way, that's exactly the way they say. You know, God has to have a hell. It wouldn't be fair to the Christians otherwise. They got to have their fun. They don't get to have their fun in this life. I saw a bumper sticker the other day that was really good. It said, what do Christians have to give up? What do you have to give up to be a Christian? Said hell. That's all you have to give up. That's what you get out of. Have you ever thought this way, though? Say, boy, look at me, striving, fasting, whiplashing myself on spiritually, and washing my hands in incense all the day long. I've been plagued and chastened every morning. If I say I'll speak thus, behold, I would offend against the generation of your children. When I thought to know this, it was too painful for me. Till I got back to God. I got my mind off of the physical, off of things, off of human temporary laughter. Then I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I understood. It's all in their end. What's their latter end? What's going to happen to them on down the trail? You could just see over the hill like God does. You wouldn't want to be in that guy's car driving. Surely, God, I see now you set them in slippery places. You cast them down into destruction. How suddenly they're brought to desolation as in a moment. How quickly they're utterly consumed with terror as a dream when one awakes. So, O Eternal, when you awake, when you arise, you're going to despise this image of which they've dreamed. So my heart was grieved, I was pricked in my reins,
So foolish was I, brutish was I, and ignorant, like a beast before you. So brutish is like animal, just being like giving back to your animal nature instead of using your brain and using God's Spirit. You went back to carnality, in other words. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You've held up me by my right hand. You've guided me with your counsel and afterward received me to glory. You think he didn't know what the reward of the saints is? Boy, this is a good verse. Verse 25. If the Catholics believe verse 25, they wouldn't think they got all those saints up there to pray to. Whom have I in heaven but you? You've got Father Abraham and Mary and all those immaculate ones up there, you know, and Peter and Paul and James and John and all those guys, you know. But that's not what David said. David knew he didn't have anybody up in heaven but God. None of the others had gone there. It's a good verse to show that. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there's none on earth I desire beside you. My flesh and my heart fails, but God is the strength. Here again is that Hebrew word rock, zur. God is the rock of my heart, and my portion forever. For lo, they that are far from you shall perish. So that's the key, you know. Don't let yourself get far from God. You begin to envy the wicked, and then in pride you're going to have things happen to you. And no, you better get back to God's sanctuary, and then you get God's word for it, and then you escape it. Lo, they that are far from you shall perish. You've destroyed all them that go a-whoring from you. But it's good for me to draw near to God. I have put my trust in the Lord eternal. I may declare all your works. Now in Psalm 74, this is an instructive writing of Asaph. The word meshal meaning instruction. Of course, we've already had many of those. There are 13 of them in the book of Psalms. Hopefully you're not superstitious. Psalm 32 was the first one. O God, why have you cast us off forever? We've had that before, Psalm 43:2 and 44:9. Why does your anger smoke against the sheep of your pasture? Now that's a terminology you find mentioned quite a bit in Asaph's writings. Psalm 79, verse 13, you'll see that same thing again. Sheep of God's pasture. Well, it's in Jeremiah and Ezekiel too, so not unique to him. Remember your congregation or your assembly, which you have purchased of old. You redeemed it and acquired it. You bought it back to yourself a long time ago. Exodus 15:16 exactly. The rod of your inheritance, the scepter, which you have redeemed. This Mount Zion, wherein you dwell, lift up your feet unto the perpetual desolations. In other words, they realized God was a God of form like a human, and he traveled, he walked, he ran, he comes swiftly. Lift up your feet. In other words, run over here and see these perpetual desolations. That's the same word as forever up in verse 1. So perpetual and forever come from the same Hebrew there. Even all that the enemy has done wickedly in the sanctuary. Your enemies or adversaries roar in the midst of your congregations or your assembly. They set up their ensigns for signs. So you can look back and remember some of those mixed multitude that came out of Egypt and how the enemies roared in the midst of God's people, and the mixed multitude made them go astray. They set up their leaders. A man was famous according as he had lifted up axes upon the thick trees, but now they break down the carved work thereof at once with axes and hammers. So everywhere you find a servant and the prophet of God, you always find Satan infiltrating it with false shepherds and false prophets and Dathans and Abirams, with some of the other famous rebels of the past. And instead of building up, they break down. And for a while, a man's fame hinged on him building up. But then later on, the man's fame or renown became because of his tearing down. You can say that about God's church today, too, in our day. That's happened again. They've cast fire into your sanctuary or caused your sanctuary to be burned with fire. They've defiled by casting down the dwelling place of your name to the ground. They said in their hearts, let us destroy both together, the sanctuary and God's dwelling place. They've burned up all the synagogues of God in the land. Now, when's that all applying to? Well, those false leaders of Israel did that. Solomon did that in a way. They did that in the New Testament times. We see not our signs. We don't see the signs of God's presence and power. We don't see the smoke, the pillar of fire. There's no more any prophet. We've got these false leaders. Neither is there among us any that knows how long. O God, how long shall the adversary reproach? You know, when I read this, I think about Christianity and how Satan took the name and used all the false leaders and brought in all the different denominations. And boy, that's well pictured in this psalm. But you don't see signs of God's presence in all those Christians. Oh God, how long shall the adversary reproach? How long shall the enemy blaspheme your name forever? You withdraw you your hand, even your right hand. Pluck it out of your bosom. In other words, intervene. Take action. Don't just let it continue. For God is my King of old, working salvation or deliverance in the midst of the earth. You did divide the sea by your strength. So always one of the great miracles, they go back to Exodus 14 and God cleaving the waters and separating the Red Sea. You break the heads of the dragons in the waters, the crocodiles, the symbol of Egypt. You break the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gave him to be nourishment to the people inhabiting the wilderness. So apparently that one of the giant dinosaurs was edible. It was cloven-footed and chewed the cud because God gave it to be food to the people inhabiting the wilderness. You did cleave the fountain and the flood, so God divided the Jordan and the Red Sea. You dried up mighty rivers. The day is yours, the night also is yours. You've prepared the light and the sun. You set all the borders of the earth. You've made summer and winter. So you have seven you, starting in verse 13. Verse 14, twice in verse 15. Verse 16, then twice in verse 17. So again and again and again, you see the perfection of God's writing and the numbers. Remember this, the enemy has reproached, O Eternal, and that the foolish people have blasphemed your name. And when is this? But before Armageddon, when Christ is going to come back and they blaspheme Christ's name and say he's the Antichrist? Oh, deliver not the soul of your turtle dove. That was one of the birds allowed to be sacrificed by the poor. So God's saints are likened unto the turtle dove. Oh, don't deliver the soul of your turtle dove unto the multitude of the wicked. In other words, don't let the captivity of Israel also include your turtle doves, your harmless sacrifices. You've got to spare them, God. There's got to be a place of safety. So here you come again, another place of safety, every time you turn around. Don't forget the congregation of your poor forever. Here's the Hebrew word hena, which means oppressed. Have respect unto the covenant, for the dark places of the earth are full of the habitations of cruelty. Now, there's another thing, you know. People think there was the Abrahamic covenant. You know, then they get these intellectual religious terminologies, and they talk about this covenant and that covenant, and there ain't but one covenant. Same covenant. God remembered his covenant. Exodus 1 says God remembered his covenant, which he'd made with Abraham, Isaac. God made the same covenant with Jacob. Same covenant. There's never been a new covenant, except when God's Spirit came, and the only difference was now you had the spiritual rewards, and you had God's Holy Spirit, and you kept the law in the Spirit. But it's the same law, same land, promised forever. So notice way down in the end time setting, Asaph said, for God to have respect unto the covenant. Not a covenant or a new one, but the covenant. For the dark places of the earth are full of the habitations of cruelty, nations of violence, and dark places of the earth. It's kind of like Cuba and Central America and Russia and third power countries. Oh, don't let the oppressed return ashamed. Let the poor and needy praise your name. Arise, O God. Plead your own cause. Remember how the foolish man reproaches you daily. Don't forget the voice of your enemies. The tumult of those that rise up against you increases continually. So notice the resistance against Christ when he comes is a multitude, a mass of waters, numbers of people. Then another psalm song, same double title that David said, a psalm song of Asaph. Unto you, O God, we give thanks. Unto you we give thanks, because your name is near. Your wondrous works declare. Now, we read Psalm 75 when we covered the millennial psalms, and Psalm 76. In Judah, God is known. Now, of course, that's not true today. But that's going to be true when the time setting of Psalm 76 takes place. Then he talks about Jerusalem, the capital of Judah, in verse 2. He talks about God's supernatural conquest of the enemy. Verse 7, who's going to stand at the time of this trouble? Well, you go right back to Revelation 7 for the answer there. Who's going to stand? Now, Psalm 77. To the chief musician belongs above on 76. Now you have a psalm of Asaph. That's the only part that belongs to 77. Apparently Psalm 76 was designated as to Jeduthun. Now Psalm 77. I cried unto God with my voice. Unto God with my voice. And he gave ear unto me. So here God, as if he leans over and inclines his ear, gives ear. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Eternal. My sore ran in the night. The Hebrew word really here says, my hand was outstretched. It doesn't necessarily mean he had a boils, or certainly doesn't indicate he had a venereal disease, as some people said in the past. The Hebrew says, my hand was outstretched. Doesn't necessarily mean a sore. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained, communed with myself, and my spirit was overwhelmed. Here the word is ruach. I was just down, hopeless, selah. So after giving you this picture of crying to God, stretching out his hands, soul refusing to be comforted, then he comes back to the positive and says, you hold mine eyes, or you see mine eyelids, you keep mine eyelids from closing, you're going to keep me alive, you're going to keep me awake, God, you're not going to let me die a perpetual sleep of death. I'm so troubled that I cannot speak. I've considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song, in the night. I come in with mine own heart. My spirit made diligent search. Will the eternal cast off forever? Will he be favorable no more? Now, you know, you never know. When you're in a time like that, you look back and you remember you felt that way before, but God always brought you out of it. But you always think, well, maybe he won't this time. Maybe that was the last time, and this is once too many, you know, and I went one time too far. So apparently that's what's going on here in his thinking. So as he thinks back about ancient times and how he went through this before, he said, in his grace, is his grace plain gone forever? Does his promise fail forevermore? Has God, has forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Selah. So now all this previous mercy or misery is connected with what you find later with what God is going to do. Above he said, me and my and I and all the trouble I had, I said, this is my infirmity, but I'll remember the years of the right hand. I'll remember the power and God's vigorous intervention and God's deliverance. I'll remember the doings or works of the Yah. Here's Yah again. Surely I'll remember your wonders, your works of old. I'll meditate also of all your work and talk of your doings. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. In other words, when we're close to God and with God, and God is with us. Who is so great a God as our God? You, the eternal, that do wonders. You've declared, you've made known your strength among the people. You have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. Now, why would he say that? Well, because Jacob's name was named on Joseph. So not only did he save the sons of Jacob, but also, especially, Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Jacob. Think about that. Selah. The waters saw you, O God, the masses of peoples and armies, as well as the Red Sea and the Jordan. The waters saw you. They were afraid. The depths also were troubled. The clouds poured out water. The sky has sent out a sound, thundering. Your arrows, lightning, also went abroad. The voice of your thunder was in the heaven. The lightnings lightened the world. The earth trembled and shook. This showing God's presence is like a thunderstorm and the lightning. Your way was in the sea. You dried it up. Your path in the great waters. Your footsteps are not known. Your footprints. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Then Mashil of Asaph. This is another one for instruction. The 10th out of the 13 we'll see. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears. So we told God to incline his ears to our prayers. So now God says, yeah, all right, it's your turn now. You incline your ears to the words of my mouth. Let's open the book. Get your eyeballs on the book. Incline your ears to the scriptures. I'll open my mouth in a parable. I'll utter dark sayings of old. Now, of course, Christ quoted that in Matthew 13. I'll open my mouth in a parable. I'll utter dark sayings. Now notice the parable then is not a beautiful, simplistic Will Rogers country analogy or explanation. That's not what it is. A parable is dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known or come to know, and our fathers have told us. We won't hide them from their children, their sons. Recounting and showing to the generation to come the praises of the Eternal and his strength, his wonders and miracles that he's done. He established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel. So you notice again, how much prophecy can you understand without Israel? And what was that old covenant? It wasn't just a law. It had testimonies. It had statutes, judgments. He commanded all of these to our fathers that they should make them known to their children. So that law, you remember back there, that the generation to come might know them, even the children that should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of El, the name God again there, but keep his commandments. So now Elohim and El, it's both of their commandments. Might not be as their fathers, a stubborn, rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, and whose spirit wasn't steadfast, wasn't consistent, wasn't stable. The children of Ephraim, boy, now he zeroes in on them individually. The 10 nations, armed, carrying bows, turned back in the day of battle because they lost their faith in God. They didn't depend on God to fight their battle, so they had the equipment and went out to war, but their trust wasn't in God. They didn't keep the covenant of God. They refused to walk in his law. They forgot his works and his miracles or wonders he'd showed them. Marvelous things he did in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt, in the field of Zoan. He divided the sea, caused them to pass through. He made the waters to stand as an heap. It's probably well pictured in that movie, The Ten Commandments, because the waters stand as a heap. They keep coming down. They keep building up, building up. So that fits this scripture. In the daytime also, he led them with a cloud, all the night with a light of fire. He clave the rocks. Shows he did it more than once. Several times he did that. The rocks, Zur, same word, rocks otherwise, gave them drink as out of the great depths, deep spring. So it seems to say only God would have known that spring would have been there. You don't get spring out of a solid rock like that Moses spring is. He brought streams also out of the rock, not among the rocks and out in the lower valleys, caused waters to run down like rivers. And yet they sinned, missed the mark, yet more against him, by provoking the Most High, Elyon. You'll find that again. Well, it was in 77. We ran over that. Psalm 77, verse 10. They tempted God in their heart by asking meat for their lust, their soul. Can you imagine that? The translators in 1611 translated the word naphesh, lust. That's a real unique translation of naphesh, but it shows they knew what it meant. Asking meat for their soul. That's what you ask meat for, your soul. Yet they spake against God. They said, can God furnish a table in the wilderness? Behold, he smote the rock that the waters gushed out and the streams overflowed. Can he give bread also? Can he provide flesh for his people? So in this case, it wasn't like in the New Testament, as if they'd forgotten about the loaves and fishes. They didn't forget, they knew. So there's a difference between these carnal Israelites and those disciples in the New Testament. These people reiterated what God had done, but said, how much can he do? Therefore the Eternal heard and was wroth, so a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also came up against Israel. Because they didn't believe God, they didn't trust in his salvation or deliverance. They didn't have any confidence in it. Though he had commanded the clouds from above, he'd ordered the skies to give rain, he'd opened the doors of heaven, he'd rained down manna on them to eat. Well, that doesn't say they picked it off the manna trees. Some scholars would have you believe there are trees that grow such a thing to avoid any miracles, you know. There are trees that grow little things and you collect it and knead it together and make bread out of it. And of course, you show me one of those trees that doesn't produce any of that on Saturday, you know, and produces twice as much on Friday. Now, that's a pretty unique tree if you can do that. Well, he rained down manna upon them to eat. He had given them of the corn of heaven. Well, that's what God calls manna, the corn of heaven. Didn't come off trees. Man did eat angel food cave. Kind of like that. Bread of the mighty, bread of the angels. He sent the meat to the full. God didn't send devil food cake, but angel food cake. So he causes an east wind to blow in the heaven, and by his power he brings in the south wind, and sure enough, from the south and the east you can rain doves. Blow them right back from where they're wanting to fly. So he rained flesh, blew them right back there, on them like dust. Feathered fowls like as the sand of the sea. So the same kind of rain that rained manna rained doves, rained the birds. He let it fall in the midst of their camp round about their habitation. So they did eat, and they were filled, for he gave them their own desire. They were not estranged. They hadn't even turned away from their lust, what they'd longed for. While their dove was yet in their mouth, God's wrath came on them and slew the fattest of them and smote down the chosen men of Israel. I didn't mean those that ate the most. It meant the choice of them, not the ones that ate the most, thankfully. Anyway, he goes on, verse 32, and he said, for all this they sinned still. They didn't believe for his wondrous works. Therefore their days he did consume in vanity, and their years in trouble. When he slew them, then they sought him, and they returned and inquired early after God. And they remembered that God was their rock and the high God, El Elyon. Now he puts those two names together. So these writers especially like to use all these different names for God. El Elyon. Nevertheless, they did flatter him with their mouth. They lied to him with their tongues, for their heart was not right with him, neither were they steadfast in his covenant. You notice Mr. Armstrong's always emphasizing the attitude of heart. That's what sin is. It isn't a Talmud of what you do and what you don't do. It starts out with your attitude. So it's already a sin even if you get that attitude, whether you do it or don't do it. But too many people give away their depth of conversion by always harking back to the letter of the law and the physical. It makes somebody kind of scratch their head and wonder how spiritual you are if you don't see the spirit of sin before you literally get into the letter of sin. But too many people want a line drawn as to the letter of sin. Now that's a dead giveaway as to their depth of spirituality. But he, full of compassion, forgave their iniquity, the vanity of their nature, Avon, and destroyed them not, didn't lay them waste. Yea, many a time he turned his anger away and didn't stir up all of his wrath. Well, God got angry, but he didn't let it go very far. For he remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passes away and doesn't come again. How oft did they provoke him in the wilderness? At least 10 times the number of judgments grieved him in the desert. Yea, they turned back again and again and tempted God. And here's the real giveaway. Limited. Set a mark as to what God could and couldn't do. You can't do that. God wants a 100-year-old to have a baby, you're going to have one. So you can't set a mark and say, God, you can come this far no further. You can't limit the Holy One of Israel. That's another one of those places we find that title. They didn't remember his hand, nor the day when he delivered them from the enemy, how he had wrought his signs in Egypt, his wonders in the field of Zoan, and had turned their rivers into blood, and their floods that they couldn't drink. He sent different sorts of flies among them, the fourth plague that devoured them, then the frogs, the second plague that destroyed them. He gave their increase to the caterpillar, the corn locust, and their labor to the locust. He destroyed their vines with hail, the seventh plague, and their fig trees with frost. He gave up their cattle also to the hail, and their flocks to hot thunderbolts. Lightning struck them. He cast upon them the fierceness of his anger, wrath and indignation and trouble, by finally letting loose evil angels He made a way to his anger. He spared not their soul from death. Now, that's a good use for the word soul. He gave their life over to the pestilence. Smote all the firstborn in Egypt, chief of their strength in the tabernacles of Ham. Now, look at that. Tabernacles of Ham. Temporary dwelling. Tabernacle. This is the Hebrew word oil, not the word sukkah, because it's Gentile. You wouldn't expect the tabernacles of Ham to be sukkah, but oil. Now, what are the tabernacles of Ham, anyway? Well, Egypt's one of them. Those countries in North Africa are some of the others of them. But made his own people to go forth like sheep, guided them in the wilderness like a flock, and he led them gently on safely so that they feared not. But the sea overwhelmed their enemies, and he brought them to the border of his sanctuary, to the Holy Land, even to this mountain, Mount Moriah, Mount Zion, which his right hand had purchased. You notice, they didn't take it away from the Canaanites. Rotten Israelites came in there and take a land away from people it belongs to. Why does it belong to them? You know, we need to get our minds cleaned up on that. God divided to the people their land. Remember that in Acts 7? God divided to the people their land. It isn't first come, first serve. It isn't losers, weepers, finders, keepers. It isn't whoever gets it, keeps it. Where do you ever get that? God is God, and God allotted the peoples and allotted the lands all those people should be on. The people are always talking about it. Who's been there the longest? Who was there first? I don't know what that's got to do with it. Who did God give it to? And whoever God gave it to, that's who it's going to go back to. So Americans are going to be run out of Africa. Americans are going to be run out of Arabia. Canaanites are going to be run out of Palestine. And Canaanites are going to be run out of America. Because God divided to the people their land and proportioned by lot their inheritance. It didn't matter who's there first. So God brought them to this mountain which his right hand had purchased. And don't ever forget that. Americans aren't here because they ran those poor Indians out. Satan tried to make a liar out of God by getting the Indians over here in the first place. God had reserved this land for Manasseh. It wasn't for the Indians. Boy, and you don't ever read that in history books, I'll guarantee you. God cast out the heathen. Now notice, God did that. Don't blame the people. God cast out the nations also before them. God divided them in inheritance by line. Very exactly and very precisely. Here's your border. These are the tabernacles of Ham. These are the tabernacles of Shem. You go here, you go there. This is your area. He made the tribes of Israel by line to dwell in their tents. Yet they tempted and provoked the Most High God, Elohim Elyon here, and kept not his testimonies, but they turned back and dealt unfaithfully like their fathers. They were turned aside like a deceitful bow, for they provoked him to anger with their high places. They moved him to jealousy with their graven images. When God heard, he was wroth and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he forsook the habitation. Mishkan is the Hebrew word there, of Shiloh. So tabernacle there is talking about the religious place of worship of Shiloh, where they first set up, Judges 18:1. But God forsook it, the tent that he placed among men, delivered his strength into captivity, his glory into the enemy's hand. He gave his people over, that's his strength and his glory, his people, unto the sword, and was wroth with his inheritance. All that's going to happen again. The fire consumed their young men. Their maidens weren't given to marriage. Their priests fell by the sword. Their widows made no lamentation. Then the Eternal awakened as one out of sleep, and that's what he's going to do in the future. Like a mighty man that shouts. There he is, secret rapture again. He's by reason of wine. You whisper, I guess, when you got too much wine. He smote his enemies in the hinder parts, put them to a perpetual reproach. Moreover, he refused the tabernacle of Joseph. That's right, that's not going to be capital, Britain or America, no London or Washington. He didn't even choose the tribe of Ephraim. He chose the tribe of Judah, the Mount Zion, which he loved. He built his sanctuary like high places, like the earth that he'd established forever. He's going to raise back up David, too, his servant. He's taken him from the sheepfold so God could do it through him and not depend on his own talent and his own experience and background. You know, we had men who said, we're going to be professional ministers. You know, it was said in one district conference, why, the only thing you needed to be in the old days to be a good minister was to be a good driver and have endurance. I didn't like that too much when I heard that. You know, I'd rather be a freckle-faced, ugly David any day than an impressive, talented Saul or a wise, intellectual Solomon. Somehow they hadn't made it. But look what God did. This scrawny, freckle-faced, tail-ender David. God chose David, his servant. Took him from the sheepfold, following the ewes, great with young. That was his biggest responsibility, wondering when some lamb would be born, how to protect it and shield it. He brought him to feed Jacob his people and Israel his inheritance. So he fed them according to the integrity of his heart. He guided them by the skillfulness of his hand. Well, we'll have to pick up a 79 next time. And 78 is one of the great psalms of the Bible.